The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Stephen Lee Nation's writing explores film, politics, and popular culture, and the places where they converge. His essays have appeared in numerous journals and periodicals, including The Quietus, Empty Mirror, and 3AM. And his book, Deconstructing Dirty Dancing, is out now from Zero Books. Lisa Palmer, managing editor of The Moving Image, reviewed Steve's book this way. Dirty Dancing has quietly evolved from a film to enjoy to one you can admire. Helped along by Stephen Lee Nation's Deconstructing Dirty Dancing, a model of detailed textual analysis, Deconstructing Dirty Dancing reveals what Dirty Dancing's devoted fan base has known for years, that the film tackled sophisticated, progressive themes with dignity, courage, and a catchy soundtrack. Rest assured, the political can indeed be pleasurable. It's Wednesday, April 26, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features a second half of conversations from this podcast, sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left, and sometimes features public lectures from Zero Book authors or staff. Zero Book Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others monthly. Right now you're listening to Trot the Fox, performed by the Cologne Ballroom Orchestra. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Stephen Nation and I discuss Deconstructing Dirty Dancing. Stephen Lee Nash is the author of Deconstructing Dirty Dancing, which is due out in April from Zero Books. He's the author also of a book called Create or Die, Essays on the Artistry of Dennis Hopper, which came out from Amsterdam University Press, and several other books. He's written for Candid Magazine, The Quietus, Empty Mirror, 3AM, The Everyday Analysis blog, and other publications. Stephen Lee Nash, welcome to the Zero Books podcast.
Thanks ever so much for having me, Doug. It's a real pleasure to be on here, actually.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you. I want to start out with a really simple-minded question. The book's title is Deconstructing Dirty Dancing. And what I want to ask you is, what is it to deconstruct something? What is deconstruction? Something that I maybe pretend to know a good portion of the time and think I know, but when pressed, I don't know if I could define it. So I'll ask you, what does it mean to deconstruct something, and what is deconstruction?
You know, in the terms of my book, it's really kind of breaking down the film and breaking down its meaning. And in my book, I break it down in a number of ways. So firstly, I take a look at a comparative study of the film, and in comparison to David Lynch's Blue Velvet, which came out the year before Dirty Dancing came out. And there's kind of similarities between the two films in certain sense. And then the bulk of the book is literally breaking down the film in not necessarily scene by scene, but just moment by moment, I guess would be the best sort of way to describe it. And connecting kind of each scene to either history or politics of the time that it was made, which was the 1980s, and the time in which it was set, which was the early 1960s. And that takes up the bulk of the book, just breaking it down. And in my book, it's broken down by, you know, almost like time frame. And then the third or last concluding section of the book kind of breaks the film down on a personal level. So what the film kind of means to me and what it has meant to me over the years. And my relationship to this particular film has really kind of changed over the course of, I don't know, like 25 years, I guess. So
it's been 30, I think, hasn't it?
Well, exactly. Yeah. 30 years since the film actually came out. It's the 30th anniversary this year. And which is kind of a bit of a coincidence, I got to say, because this kind of book was written maybe 2 years ago and was almost ready to be published 2 years ago. And but it's probably 20 to 25 years since I actually first saw the film when I was maybe 8 or 9. So I'm not sure if I've answered your question of deconstruction there, but
let me take another pass at just the deconstruction part of it. I mean, I'm interested in talking about Dirty Dancing and your approach to interpretation, but my understanding is Derrida is the theorist that invented the idea of deconstruction. And maybe I'm overstating it, but I think that's right. And with deconstruction, there's this notion that anytime you approach a text that you can't arrive at a final meaning, that interpretation is a process which will never find a bottom, basically, or never find an ultimate meaning. Your deconstruction, what makes your approach a deconstruction of the text is that you don't have only one approach to the text, or you aren't looking for an ultimate understanding or meaning for the movie.
Yeah, no, I come to a lot of different conclusions about this film. It's not towards one goal, but really, you know, it was really about my own kind of goal in wanting to understand it better, because, you know, my relationship to the film has changed. And I really wanted to delve into that. If I can, like, you know, just sort of take it for a second. You know, when I was a kid, this film meant quite a lot to me, weirdly enough, when I was 8 or 9, because it was a film that me and my family could really kind of get into. You know, like we'd sit around and watch it together. And I was in love with the soundtrack to the film, you know, and I still think that the soundtrack is just incredible. And then as I got older, you know, my teenage years, I got very distant from it because it's not a film that you're kind of meant to like as a young male. And but in my as I kind of got older into my 20s and, you know, was reading more and analyzing more, I kind of realized that actually there was something about this particular film, a film that was from my youth, which it hadn't devolved, it had evolved in my understanding, whereas a lot of films from that time when I was a kid had kind of just become, you know, obsolete in their meaning, I guess, whereas Dirty Dancing had sort of picked up meaning along its way, if that kind of makes sense.
I'll just tell you about my experience of Dirty Dancing. I'm older than you are. I'm 46, I'll just say that, although I think people who listen to my podcast hear me say my age maybe like every other episode. So I'm obsessed with it. But I saw this film in 1987 in the theater when it came out. I also ended up with the soundtrack from the movie. I don't remember how I ended up with it. Probably incorrect memory is that somehow or another I got a cassette tape recording of the soundtrack from a girlfriend. And that's important because the movie, when I saw the movie in 87, I was 16. I wasn't really dating very much. I continued to listen to the soundtrack because of this girl in my life. It sort of defined a certain teenage romantic vision for me, and it summed up my high school experience. The best parts of it maybe are the romanticized parts of it, as I reached towards adulthood. But then I remember kind of discussing the movie. I don't remember why, but I remember discussing the movie with a high school friend in a cafe in Denver, and both of us just knocking it, you know, just saying, oh my God, thank God the 80s are behind us. And for me, that's maybe the last time I seriously thought about that movie. And it was sort of put on the dust heap of history. It's an 80s relic. It's a represents everything that was wrong with Hollywood or something. I'm very snooty appraisal, I'm sure. But am I wrong? Has this movie continued to have legs? Is it kind of a cult movie now? Is it an intergenerational movie? I mean, must be, because you didn't see it when it came out in the theater.
No, I didn't. It would have been like a few years after, and it would have been like on a VHS cassette. I just think your kind of memory of it there is actually it is just so, that's so great. My memory of it would have been more sort of involved with my kind of my mom, my dad, and my sister. You know, my mom and my sister probably really loved that film, and I loved it probably initially because they did. But then, you know, the soundtrack was something that I really was hooked into even as a young kid. And you know, when you're that young, when you're 9 or 10, you know, the you've got no kind of you don't really have any feelings towards the main protagonist, the female protagonist. You're too young to kind of acknowledge that. But you know, my draw would have been towards the Swayze character and been sort of like, well, is that kind of how adult masculinity is kind of represented? Is that what I'm going to be attaining to? And that was kind of an interesting thing. But then when you get into your teenage years, that flips completely, and you don't, you know, there's no way that you can ever attain the kind of coolness of Swayze or the coolness of Johnny Castle. So, but yeah, to answer your question, I think over the years it has developed, and the people who saw it originally, the predominantly female audiences who saw it in the 1980s, it's stuck with them throughout. But I think it's also picking up a younger generation as well of female audiences as well, and that's been helped along, I think, by the musical that was done about 7 or 8 years ago, I think, and that's still running, you know, and that's also increased its interest. But also as well, you know, even when it was released in the 1980s, like, it was a nostalgic film even then, because it was set in the 1960s. So it just feels like it hasn't aged, which is an odd thing to say, because it was released as aged, you know, it was released as nostalgia, but it's still fresh, like when you see it today. And I think that's taking it back to the soundtrack. I think that's a lot to do with the soundtrack, because if you hear that soundtrack, the songs from the early 1960s sound fresh.
I want to talk about the soundtrack, but I also want to talk about Patrick Swayze and the kind of film that Dirty Dancing was. You know, I guess if I was 9, I might have thought I wanted to be like Patrick Swayze. But as a teenager, one thing about the movie that struck me was that as much as it was about sexual awakening, at its center in the Patrick Swayze character, despite his moves, despite the way he danced, you had a kind of neutered male protagonist, I think, and more to the point, it not necessarily truly neutered, but a sexually ambiguous male protagonist. And it reminds me of how, like, in the 60s, when the Beatles were becoming very popular with teenage girls, one of the things about that was that they looked rather feminine. And Patrick Swayze, while not looking feminine, there was a kind of a queer side to his character. He was interested in dance. Totally. And so he was kind of a safe male romantic lead. And also, of the two characters, he was the better looking of the two. So it was also, it was definitely, the whole film was like a female fantasy. It was a woman's fantasy. And despite that, I mean, or maybe because of it, I think the movie has some power. And I actually remember finding the leading lady in the movie to be very attractive because she wasn't perfect. Because she looked like someone I might want to date. It was like in my ballpark, you know, with the, her nose wasn't perfect or whatever. Later on, she fixed that, I guess. But anyway, all that, that's all personal garbage, maybe. But I do think that there's something to the fact that there was a, it's a chick flick, kind of. It's a feminine movie, really. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with that. And I think what you say there about Jennifer Grey not being as attractive as Patrick Swayze, like, I kind of do agree with that. And I think that's also why, you know, it does appeal to a female audience as well, because they can see themselves in Frances Hausman. You know, they don't have to be incredibly attractive. But Swayze is, you know, I mean, he just had an incredible, he has a very effeminate face, and, you know, he's not got a big bulky body, but it's well chiseled. So, yeah. But yeah, so I really kind of agree with what you said there.
But the main thing I guess I'm missing from this is, maybe it's because I saw it when I was a teenager, is how this movie still plays. Is it still playing to mostly women audiences? Is it considered, is it like Clue? Some sort of cult hit that I'll never understand? Or what is it about Dirty Dancing that gives it its legs 30 years on, do you think?
I think it's just the, you know, the kind of, the fact that it is well regarded, or at least being now regarded as a kind of feminist film.
Okay.
And so that's kind of opened it up to more academic kind of studies anyway. But, you know, I just think it's the elation of the film itself. It's such a, it's almost, it is almost like the Rocky of I don't want to call it a chick flick, but the Rocky of romantic comedies, you know?
Yeah, I'll be politically incorrect.
No, that's, I just, yeah, it's, that's fine. No, chick flick is can definitely still be applied. But yeah, it is almost the Rocky. It's this, the build that you get throughout the film, and then that last sort of 15 minutes of where everybody's just come together and they're dancing, and you know, there's no division between anybody anymore. And that, I mean, you know, I don't know how much it plays in movie theaters anymore, but, you know, I don't know if it's a cliche about kind of, you know, girls coming over to each other's houses for pajama parties and watching Dirty Dancing. And it, you know, between five or six people, it becomes this great elation. But yeah, in terms of like cinema audiences, I mean, I don't think it plays so much anymore. It probably will this year, though, somewhere.
Has it been on, this is one that maybe you won't be able to answer, but has it been on Netflix or anywhere? Has it had a second life in the streaming world? Do you know about that?
No, as far as I know, it hasn't. It's definitely, I'm in Canada, so I get the Canadian Netflix, which is nowhere near as good as the US Netflix or the UK. So it could be on there. But DVD sales of this film still rack up millions every year. So it's still an ongoing thing. So that's kind of where it is. And
that's probably why it's not on Netflix.
Yeah, probably. Because. Yeah, it probably is, because it's just one of those things. It's almost like the physical ownership of it is also important, as well as the, you know, just being able to watch it. So, yeah, I don't think it's not picked up too much on, you know, kind of interest in streaming, but still people go out and buy it every year, millions.
Let's talk about the soundtrack a little bit. For me, it reminded me of the American Graffiti soundtrack. And the movie, in a way, is a similar movie to American Graffiti. It takes place in the same time period. But it's odd, because American Graffiti was aimed at my parents' generation, and Dirty Dancing was definitely aimed at my generation, at teenage girls, and maybe younger women, or maybe older women too, but definitely teenage girls. And so we had the experience, people who saw that movie and listened to the soundtrack, of being nostalgic for songs we were hearing for the first time. And the American Graffiti soundtrack had a very 50s feeling, even though some of the songs were from the 60s, early 60s. But this was like a secret time period that that I didn't really even know about, the early 60s. So it was like it was the hipster side of that time period, just because I hadn't heard the songs before, maybe, or some of them. But what do you think? How did that soundtrack work for that movie?
It works because what you just kind of said there, it was almost like this hipster secret era almost, because for me, for me, like, music perhaps doesn't even start until the Beatles, because that's when music became vastly popular. And you had Sinatra, you had Elvis before that, but the Beatles was megalomania. So, but before that, whatever was kind of happening, I guess, was on a smaller scale. And, also as well, a lot of those songs that appear on that soundtrack were considered one-hit wonders. So they were only ever played once, and then there was never anything to kind of tamper with the kind of original sounds of those records. They were just, most of them, just one-hit wonders. So they hadn't been vastly overplayed, and there was nothing to kind of come after it. No, the artists didn't release another hit single that kind of watered that down. So that's kind of why it, I think, still resonates, because it's not an overplayed, throughout history, it wasn't overplayed throughout the 20th century history.
So do you think that the teenagers that were experiencing this soundtrack were feeling nostalgic for their, like, for me, I could have been, I don't think I was consciously aware of this, but I could have been feeling nostalgic for the late 70s, for the American Graffiti soundtrack, basically. But it certainly was the case that I was made to feel nostalgic for the 60s and for that early 60s in a way that really didn't make a lot of sense. I think maybe the same thing's going on now for millennials who are feeling nostalgic for the 80s. Which is also a time that they really didn't live through. So what do you make of that nostalgia for a time that wasn't experienced, that kind of artificial, commercialized nostalgia?
Well, let's try and think about this in another way. There was a film by Woody Allen like a few years ago, Midnight in Paris.
Yeah,
which really, really wonderfully broke this down, because, the character, the Owen Wilson character, steps back into the 1920s to begin with? I can't remember. He meets all these great writers, and the time is swinging. And then those guys living in that period want to go back 40 years to the time that they didn't live in. And, he just keeps going back and back and back. Everyone keeps just looking back 40 years to what they thought was probably brilliant. I think there's always that you always kind of reminisce about something that you've never really experienced, because it's all done through rose-tinted glasses. But I mean, I lived through the 90s, and I'd like to go back to the 90s again.
Well, yeah, me too. But for, the obvious reasons, it'd be nice to be 20. But I think it's interesting how nostalgia for the 60s has lasted, and I wonder if it is going to finally start to fade with this generation, or whether we will continue to be nostalgic for the baby boomer's youth after the last baby boomer has died.
Yeah, which is what, like in like 40 years time?
Well, yeah,
according to
them, yeah, probably.
Yeah, I think nostalgia for the 60s is going to be with us for a little while longer, especially as politics in the, West, mostly Western politics, especially in the UK and in the US right now, is insistent on looking back in an idea of making America great again, and in the UK getting back to a time before when we had our own laws and our own governance, without interference from Europe. You know, that all kind of goes back to the 60s and the 70s anyway. So I think while we're still in that nostalgia loop, the 60s will probably be with us for a little while longer. Yeah. I don't know how unfortunate that is. You know, I wrote a book on Dennis Hopper, who is an icon of the 1960s, although most of his work was actually done after the 60s. So, you know, and he's a guy who's kind of tied in with that whole 60s iconoclast kind of aspiration. So
for me, Dennis, there's three things that define Dennis Hopper to me. Maybe four, actually. I'll go through them. Here we go. Okay. First, easy writer.
Yeah.
And he's great in that. The second one would be his role in Apocalypse Now, which he says he didn't remember when he was he didn't remember doing that movie. And then the third key moment for him was, I forget the name of the movie, but he was in a movie in like 1990 where he has this line. He says, "The 90s are going to make the 60s look like the 50s, man."
Yeah, that's Flashback. Yeah. I tackle that film a lot in my book on Dennis Hopper. Actually, Flashback is a bit of a schism in Hopper's career. So yeah, it's a funny film. Yeah, I don't know how popular that was back in the 19. I think it was released in 1989 or 1990, and I came across it like, you know, 20 years later.
Right, I saw
a lot of people seem to have seen it, so I don't know.
I saw it on VHS in 1990. I was hoping he was right. I was like, wow, that would be awesome if it was the case. And then the final thing that I think of him for are those retirement plan ads. And he says, you know, we baby boomers aren't going to retire. You know, this is now we're just getting started. We're going to, you know, flower power and all that. And of course, he drops dead like a year after making that.
To withdraw, to go away, to disappear. That's how the dictionary defines retirement. Time to redefine. Your generation is definitely not headed for bingo night. In fact, you could write a book about how you're going to turn retirement upside down.
The best book on retirement is the one you'll write, the Dream Book. Your Ameriprise financial advisor can help you get it started and help you get to a retirement defined by your dreams.
Because I just don't see you playing shuffleboard, you know what I mean?
Why did you compare Dirty Dancing to Blue Velvet?
I wanted to compare Dirty Dancing to another film, and I wanted it to be a little bit more out there. And there are comparisons to be made with Dirty Dancing and Blue Velvet. So firstly, you know, it's there's two teenagers. Or, well, I guess Johnny Castle's not necessarily a teenager, but there is the idea of a teenager ascending to adulthood in some way. And in Francis Hausman's case, it's through sex. And Jeffrey Beaumont, the character played by Karl McLaughlin in Blue Velvet, it's also by sex, but it's a much more sinister version of, it's a sadomasochistic sex. And so I thought that was kind of interesting. They both take more or less the same trajectory into adulthood, but it's a very different consequences. And there's also this merging of times. So Dirty Dancing is a kind of merging of the 1980s with the 1960s. And Blue Velvet is also not, although it's contemporary, it's set in the 1980s. It has this kind of weird late 50s, early 60s kind of thing going on with its soundtrack, but also with the way some of the characters are even dressed and how they even act is kind of like a 1950s style of kind of acting. So that's kind of why I wanted. Yeah, I just sort of saw some comparisons between the two and just kind of thought that it would be fun to kind of to try to bring those two films together a little bit. And also as well, this stems from like years ago. There's a YouTube video out there, which I definitely encourage people to watch because it's hilarious, in which the Dirty Dancing trailer is re-edited as a David Lynch film, as if it was a David Lynch film. And so you just get these very kind of sinister things that aren't sinister in Dirty Dancing, but they become sinister in this very new context, like, you know, Patrick Swayze's character putting Francis's hand on his chest and going boom 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 boom, and that kind of echoes in this trailer, and it just becomes really really sinister. So that kind of triggered that. I think that was definitely the trigger.
Which film do you think is more significant, Blue Velvet or Dirty Dancing?
I got to say, like, you know, Dirty Dancing would not even appear in my top 10, top 20 films. Like, it's a film that I think is absolutely significant, and I do love it. But there are, like, films that, you know, are obviously more important to me. And, yeah, Blue Velvet is more important to me personally as a film. And I think it is more significant. But that's
okay. Well, that opens up an interesting line of thought, because why write a book about a movie that doesn't make your top 20? Why pick out that movie for a book when there are probably films that are in your top 20 that you haven't written about yet?
Yeah. Are you doing
something other than an analyzing or holding up a book for praise, basically? Are you doing something other than film criticism as film criticism here?
I think I wanted to sort of challenge myself a little bit. You know, this isn't a film that I've always been comfortable with, you know, and it was an idea that I wanted to challenge myself to write a book that normally a male writer perhaps wouldn't even consider writing about. But also, it was a case of trying to challenge myself. But also, when I was looking at this idea of writing a book that was just about one particular film, it's so easy to write about a film that you love because it's just all there, right? You can just go ahead and write that. But when there's one that you kind of have to really kind of challenge yourself and think about, it becomes a bit more difficult. And I just wanted that challenge, basically. And Dirty Dancing, as I've kind of explained like earlier, it's a film that I loved as a kid, I hated as a teenager, and in my early 20s, and then I became a bit more aware of it, and I became aware that it had grown in, you know, in its own way. And that was an interesting thing too, because I can't really think of any film from that period of my life. Like, and I'm not, my family weren't cinephiles in any way. I'm talking films like Short Circuit, Naked Gun. You know, none of those films evolve in the way that Dirty Dancing has. And when I was 9 or 10, I hadn't watched Blue Velvet. So, you know, this was just, it's just one film that seems to have just actually evolved from that time. It's become something different. And it's meant something different throughout my life. And I've engaged with it like hundreds of times probably in the last 25 years, because it's either cropped up in conversation or somebody's sat down and made me watch it for whatever reason, you know. So, yeah, I guess it was just an idea of wanting to challenge myself to appreciate this film more.
There's this idea that that Dirty Dancing is a woman's picture, is a chick flick, as I say. It's a romantic story that is a fantasy for a woman's sensibility. And I was thinking, well, is there a movie like that that's actually romantic that is aimed at a male sensibility? And the movie that came to mind, and I don't know if you've seen it, so I'll just ask if you've seen it first before we go on and on about it, is Say Anything with John Cusack. Have you ever seen that movie?
I have. And actually, John Cusack again, a few years later with High Fidelity.
Right.
I think that is to me a great male romantic drama slash comedy, you know. But yeah, Say Anything. I have seen it. It was a while ago. So you may have to.
Well, all I'll say is that it is a romance, but it's definitely told from the perspective of the man, of the boy or the man, in that it's not like High Fidelity, which also, you know, by the way, that's about 10 years later, I think.
Oh yeah.
High Fidelity. Yeah. And yeah. So it's a totally different kind of romance. It's not a teenage romance.
No, it definitely isn't.
It's not first love. So, but Say Anything is a male romance, and the characters are, well, the male character in Say Anything and the female character in Dirty Dancing are actually somewhat the same. They're less than their love interest, right?
Yeah.
They're, I mean, I forget the actress's name, but I think it's Ione Skye.
Ione Skye. Yeah. Yeah.
She is so beautiful and so smart and capable and Say Anything. And something similar is going on with Patrick Swayze and Dirty Dancing. You do a close, pretty close reading of the film in your book. You go through watching it minute by minute, it seems like. And what I really liked about it was how you included the some analysis of the Vestron video logo as a part of your critical analysis. What made you decide to do that?
So the kind of breakdown of the film, which is almost minute by minute or scene by scene, I just wanted to sort of say something about the literally the very start of the film. So when we get to 0000, then that's kind of where we start the analysis. And Vestron, you know, you don't – that logo, you don't see it anymore. And I kind of looked into it and I didn't know why. And, you know, it was a failed video production studio that I guess made very small films by Hollywood standards anyway. And I just wanted to include that because also Vestron. So Vestron is a mashup of ancient words, the Roman virgin goddess of hearth, Vesta, and the Greek word for instrument, Tron. So it's fitting in the context of the logo represents a theme that's explored in Dirty Dancing, the virgin goddess and the instrument that will end her virginity. So, I just thought, wow, that's actually really quite powerful, very sort of powerful thing to see at the beginning of a film, which then kind of unravels in that way. So
if you Google Vestron video, it seems like there's some nostalgia for Vestron. There's quite a lot of pages that use the logo, even though it's a defunct organization. The film Deviant has a whole page on Vestron video, a list of the 13 best Vestron video horror films. And there's a Vestron logo at the top of the page, splattered in blood.
So, yeah, they did a lot of straight to DVD kind of stuff, or at least films that were released in, you know, very limited movie theaters in the US. And I think their only reel of a hit was Earth Girls Are Easy, which came out, I think, 88. And that was one of Jim Carrey's first films.
Right.
Jeff Goldblum, and they're dressed up as neon furred aliens. It's a crazy film.
What do you see as the class critique in Dirty Dancing? How does class work its way through that film?
Johnny Castle is the working class character, and the people around him, the fellow kind of dancers and the staff, not so much the waiting staff, because you've got that Robbie Gould guy who he's going to go to medical school. He's from a much more kind of upper class background. But, you know, the people who kind of the cooks and the dancers and the people who do the laundry and things like that, they're all kind of like the working class characters. And then you have the guests who are the, the sort of middle to upper class clientele of this resort. So there's definitely kind of like a divide there, because you've got the workers and then you've got the patrons of the actual of the resort. So I thought that was like pretty interesting. And then when you get into the relationship between Johnny and Francis, there is a kind of divide there too. And I think, you know, you were talking a little bit earlier about this kind of muted masculinity of Patrick Swayze or of Johnny Castle. And I think that comes into play even more actually when him and Francis begin their relationship, because I think in some cases he's intimidated by her class or the background that she comes from, because she comes across as more intelligent than him. But you know, he in some respects there is a reversal as well, because you know, he teaches her how to dance, and she teaches him how to break out of his kind of working class environment.